and thank you for having me back. It's nice to be here in person to give this talk. So I guess what I'm going to do maybe touch on some of the motivations that inspired me to do the PhD, which the book is based on, and then the slight, it's not major, but slight emanations that happened when the book was actually published compared to the PhD. I'm not going to run you through sort of the full breadth of the arguments in the book, because what I wanted to focus on was that element of the aspects of Narrowgy's thought that claim universality in the North. So we'll be looking quite a lot at his kind of life world that the Zoroastrian community came out of in India, his experiences in India that framed that thought. But really, I wanted to look at, you know, how does that thought actually get picked up in Britain, to a certain extent the United States, to a certain extent even in continental Europe as well. But the book itself does deal with how his thought was employed in India as well. But I think what I thought I was contributing was quite original was this a South Asian thinker actually doing universal liberalism from the perspective of the global South for the global North, rather than it just being this kind of old school truncation and fulfillment argument. So this idea that, you know, the empire has come to do liberalism for South Asia, they've missed out this, we're going to fulfill it for South Asia, which is often how these sorts of histories are written, or at least in the early 2000s they're written that way. So for those of you who don't necessarily know Narrowgy's background, that well, I'm just going to give you kind of a very quick whistle stop tour of the chronology and why his kind of biography, if you want, is quite important to his thinking. So you can see he's born in 1825, he dies in 1917. His career goes through this very interesting trajectory where he is very fortunate enough to go to these British funded schools for kind of talented you know, South Asian men that's designed to kind of train in civil service and that kind of stuff. Ends up going to Elphinstone College in Mumbai, ends up then actually becoming one of the first, if not the first, South Asian professor at Elphinstone College, teaching mathematics and so on. Eventually gets involved in Parsi social reform, so the Zoroastrian community in Bombay is kind of going through a social tumult at the time, which I'll go on to talk about. Mostly interested in things like education for women, high levels of kind of getting just generally Parsis into mixed education, so being educated both in vernacular languages and in English, and that kind of thing, interested in reforming local municipal kind of councils, that sort of thing, that's quite typical of kind of what we might call the civic nationalism aspect of how the Indian National Congress gets eventually founded, and that kind of thing. Very interestingly, he then sort of pivots to business. I mean, he is a businessman from relatively early on, so in the 1850s, he's working with Parsi colleagues to set up a branch of a company that's based in Bombay in the UK. Eventually goes into business for himself. We'll see how he ends up becoming bankrupt, and then shifting his focus more exclusively to fiscal economy rather than social reform. So you can see there's a sort of liberal thread working through this in ways we might consider typical, but he's trying to find what he thinks the onus of liberalism really should be. So social reform is that sort of classic liberal institutionalism, education is the silver bullet that can, you know, gentrify people, create change from a status contract, that kind of thing. Eventually gets disillusioned with this, changes the political economy, eventually gets disillusioned with the way the political economy is done in the British Empire because of this bankruptcy and financial crises and so on, then becomes much, much more politically engaged. So not only kind of arguing for political reform, but taking on the premiership of the princely state of Burra, where he starts to see that, look, it's not enough to just run a kind of business in a, you know, sort of laissez-faire market economy situation. Clearly there is state involvement in some way in the empire that's affecting how businesses are run, and we'll see how this kind of affects his idea of the type of social contractualism that exists between Indians, or how it affects his views on that. But then most interestingly for me, how that is then transplanted into the UK. So this is what the book, I think, was trying to do mainly, to say we all know about the so-called drain theory of Narrowgy, this idea that the empire was sucking wealth out of India, rusticating South Asia to some extent, preventing it from becoming a kind of modern, modern liberal sort of democracy. But actually, I think the really interesting thing about Narrowgy that's been forgotten is to say, look, empire doesn't just rusticate South Asia, it rusticates the United Kingdom as well. And it's only through understanding the Indian experience that you can understand why the white working class are, in his view, in the same sort of predicament as the Indian peasantry to a certain extent. And I think he's really the only thinker from within the liberal framework that's doing this at the time, and it's very, very radical. So if you compare other anti-imperial critiques from the capitalist point of view at the time, Hobson's probably the key one, emerges in the early 20th century with his capitalism and imperialism, and you're taken up by Lenin and so forth. He really doesn't have much space in this for an account of people in the global south. I mean, he sees it as a problem of underconsumption in the UK, that's affecting white working class living conditions and so on. It's potentially reducing his political stability in the state. He wants to rein in empire because he sees empire as a place where capitalists are sort of getting their profits while not paying sufficient attention to the white working classes within their own communities. He has nothing to say about the normative implications of what that means to Indians or Africans and so on. Narodji is really the first liberal capitalist in this period to bring these things into a single analytical framework. And again, as I say, from the perspective of South Asia. So you can see again this timeline, a kind of progressive involvement in more radical forms of politics and political reform. Really interesting things again that very radical at the time, getting involved in the enfranchisement of women in the UK and that kind of stuff. Again, these are left out of the traditional account of Narodji in the sense that this is seen as sort of a sideshow to his main concern, which is the draining wealth from India. But what this book is trying to do is say, well, look, why is he engaging all this radical British politics? At the same time, why is he not just in the House of Parliament repeating lobbying issues for Indian interests? So why go for universal suffrage? Why go for cooperatives and that kind of thing? Stuff that wasn't really ingratiating themselves to mainstream political opinion at the time. So you can't really say it's a strategy. It's not an attempt to win allies. It's part of his actual political thought to change Britain as much as wanting to change India. So you can see that I think extracts that haven't really been looked at in great detail by previous scholars. He publishes The Rights of Labour when he's on the cusp of being elected to the House of Commons for the first time in 1892, which is about British labour. It's got nothing to do with Indians at all. He's talking about industrial courts. He's talking about forms of arbitration between capital and labour, forms of wage bargaining that have no rules, involvement of the state at all, but coming to a fairer kind of capitalist arrangement between the two wings of production, as it were. How does that feature in his political thought, and why is it that his Indian experiences allow him to make that argument? He's not necessarily ripping off social democratic governments for the time. And then, of course, the thing we know him mostly for, publishing Poverty and Unbritish Rule in India. That book really is a compendium of arguments. It's not a sort of traditional political treatise. It's a compendium of letters, speeches, that he's really done over the previous 40 years. So the object of the book was then to say, well, look, if this sort of ideology begins in 1860, why does it begin then? What are the arguments he's making for Britain and India, and why does it culminate in this book in 1901? What really is the sort of universalism that he's claiming in this book that applies to, in my view, kind of a global critique of monopoly capitalism, not just in India. Right, so I'll do a quick sort of overview of the ways he's traditionally been looked at. And this is one of the reasons I wanted to do a PhD on him, because I remember very clearly as an undergraduate that Poverty and Unbritish Rule in the South Asia history paper I did as an undergraduate was kind of starred as a primary source you should read, and then had page selections and so on. And I remember noting at the time that actually there weren't in the list of secondary sources of historians very many kind of books actually commented on why we should be looking at this or what Narodji's importance was, beyond the kind of traditional nationalist framework that he's a founding member of the Indian National Congress in 1885. He's the first person to say that in a systematic kind of mathematical way that capital's being sucked out of India to serve the imperial metropole. But that's about as far as you got. So he was a section in the book. You couldn't even find a whole journal article on him. So I thought it was quite strange that you had this person starred as kind of key reading if you're an undergraduate, but without that much kind of rigorous academic commentary on him. The other side I found with him is, insofar as there were books, a lot of them written by South Asian scholars, they were kind of celebratory biographies, so that they weren't really getting to the heart of his political thought per se. It was just that, look, here's a kind of member of the Indian nationalist pantheon, you should know a little bit about him. And the thing, of course, they wanted to really celebrate was that he was the first Indian member elected to the House of Commons in 1892, so you can see a newspaper representation of him in the Commons here. And that has been a lot of the kind of mythology around it. So, you know, yes, identifying with great wealth, but also isn't it fantastic that, you know, he managed to convince Brits to vote for him in 1892 in sufficient numbers to kind of get this role. And again, you know, newspaper sort of articles like this and commentary written about him very much how sort of, you know, this was a source of great pride for Indians. So when he returns to Bombay in 1893, you know, there are throngs of thousands of people come to greet him and so on. And so the popular imagination is being this kind of multicultural sort of, you know, nice story that we've been telling about, you know, the small number of Indians who were in Britain at that time. And there's a number of other figures like Yogananda Gosse and all these sorts of figures who kind of sit alongside Nauroji as people who try to work the London system to work for them, try to get elected to Parliament, petitioned on behalf of Indians. The new imperial history sort of, you know, wants to look at how they navigated kind of racism and were clever about, you know, the alliances they made and so on. But it's all very strategic. It's all very instrumental account. It's not really getting into, you know, if they came there with ideas, what, you know, how did their ideas stand on their own two legs? Not by just kind of regurgitating whatever will get them elected, whatever will make them allies and so on. The other thing that historiography does is really instrumentalize these Indian figures themselves. So it's about how their British allies kind of use them for their own purposes and so on, which is, you know, interesting in so far as it goes, but doesn't really get to the heart of, okay, what are the ideas that these guys from the global south are actually bringing to the imperial metropolitan, and what is, you know, the core of that critique. And I thought we summed this up quite well. So in the era of the coalition government, because Nauroji was elected as a liberal, of course, Nick Clegg calls for nominations done by Nauroji Wards, which was to kind of you know, help young people from India come here and study. It was very much in that mould of, you know, assimilating into British society and being sort of, you know, upper middle class, all that kind of stuff. It must be said that died a kind of silent death. So I think it only ran for 1 year and then just forgotten about. So I mean, it goes to show how importantly that sort of version of Nauroji is even being taken by the British establishment, and probably to a certain extent by the Indian government. Of course, this was done in collaboration with the Indian government, and I suspect, because it was just before the current dispensation in India was elected, that they're probably not especially interested in like Parsi histories of anti-imperialism, that kind of thing. So I wanted to give a very different account to this one, you know, not sort of just triumphalist, multicultural kind of one. Well, what scholarship there is on Nauroji, I mean, he does deal with him seriously, but perhaps in ways that I think, for me, the archival material didn't, you know, bear this kind of, couldn't bear the burden of this argument. So chucking around this word nationalist, I don't think makes a great deal of sense with him. And certainly what the PhD in the book said, you know, from the outset, well, look, let's just ditch nationalism because I'm not interested in this kind of dyad between colonizer, and the various forms that takes. Because I don't think, unless you're arguing for sort of a cultural sovereignty, a political sovereignty, that you can really be called a nationalist in any meaningful sense of the word. So if we, you know, just accept that, you know, that form of Indian nationalism, I think, really starts in around 1905 and kind of goes on as we know it goes on. Nauroji is at best a critic of empire. He never really asks for its dissolution. He asks for a sort of, you know, something similar to an Irish version of home rule, but within what he calls imperial paramountcy. So he's not really a nationalist in that conventional sense. So these sorts of works that saw him in that particular, through that particular lens, I was not especially interested in replicating them. The most important one where I think we get a kind of typical view of Nauroji is this one on the left, bit much under the rise and growth of economic nationalism. This idea that Nauroji is lumped in with a whole set of other figures like Talang, Renanda, so on and so forth, who came to their own conclusions about how you know, empire was economically exploitative, but then didn't really give much of a kind of individual account of agency or individual account of political thought. Basically said that, look, this is kind of a natural response that any country would have to colonialism. And it has that sort of almost prosopographical kind of attitude to it. So these guys, you know, they're educated, they're maybe from different regions, they all have certain backgrounds in academia or law. So of course they all came to the same conclusion that the empire was kind of exploitative. And in the book, I describe it as kind of Polanyi-esque. There's kind of Karl Polanyi style. There is a natural pushback against these forms of exploitation. It's kind of sociological, institutional. It's not really about individuals and their thought and their ideas. And of course, the other thing this does is lock the argument into South Asia. So if you're calling him an economic nationalist, then you're already saying, you're already one step on the way to saying, look, whatever he's doing for Britain or the critique he has of British capitalism can't necessarily fit into that mold, unless he's arguing for a world of kind of mercantilism, which I don't actually think he is. So that was a kind of the key departure point, I think, of something that I wanted to change about the way that we see him. So at no point do I say he's a nationalist in this book. And you can say even modern versions of this story sort of want to lock themselves into this paradigm. So these are both actually, you know, great books. I enjoyed them, reading them a lot. So Producing India by Manu Goswami, fantastic book that, you know, does say that, look, there is a post-colonial nationalism that isn't a simple argument of diffusion. You're not just getting modular European nation state sort of implanted into India. But like the Bipanchandra book, it is still saying that there's these collections of things in India who have a kind of natural response to various frameworks of capital that the British have put on you. So that might be the railways, it might be the tariff system. They're all kind of acting against this in almost an unthinking sort of institutional way. Divya Patel's book, very recently published, absolutely fantastic. I mean, the first book really to kind of get properly into the narrative archives in Delhi, and there's sort of 20,000, 30,000 items in there. So there's a lot to kind of look at there that most scholars didn't really bother with, partly because they're quite hard to work with. And mostly looked at his printed stuff. So it's a great, great book for doing a kind of detailed biographical overview of what Nauroji's about. But again, as you can see from the subtitle, Pioneer of Nationalism, he's still within that framework that I've described that I did not really want to work with. So what were my kind of slowly jumping off points? Well, the first was definitely Chris Bailey's work to Recovering Liberty. So I started my PhD the year before Chris published this book, but he'd obviously written it by the stage. He was my supervisor as well, so I was having quite detailed discussions with him about, you know, what he made of Nauroji. I think he made, for me, a lot of critical kind of interventions about Nauroji as a thinker, right? So a serious kind of theoretical individual who was trying to do his own thing with the way liberalism worked in India and had his own kind of conceptual information. So one of the ones Chris mentions is benign sociology, this idea that he innovates lots of kind of statistical methods, quantitative methods, questionnaires, and so on, to get at the heart of what liberalism or liberal capitalism is doing to India, and then from that extrapolating a kind of new political theory. But obviously, because Chris was dealing with a range of thinkers across pretty much 100 years or 120 years in that book, Nauroji's only sort of, you know, a section within a chapter. So part of this was kind of doing a bigger standalone study thing. And Chris doesn't get into the detail of the British side of things that much. Again, it's mostly focused on India, for obvious reasons, because the book was concerned with liberalism in India. The other one that's perhaps, I think, less expected is Islam Bond, the Jealousy of Trade. So this had been published, I think, in 2007. So well before Chris's book, or before I started working, because I mean, I only started as an undergraduate in 2007. But one of the, I think this is more the implicit arguments of Islam's book, is that a lot of 18th century political thought in Europe was essentially dealing with this tension. It may not have resolved it, but was addressing the tension that once you moved from the age of mercantilism into the age of free trade, almost counterintuitively, you got more potential international tensions between countries rather than less. So you would think that economic independence or interdependence between countries in an age of free trade ought to create less tension, right? And that's almost the conventional wisdom today. If someone's your biggest trading partner, you're not going to go to war with them and all that kind of thing. Plenty of evidence suggests that's not true, but that seems to be conventional wisdom. What Islam says is a lot of these thinkers, even Adam Smith, Hume, and so on, are saying, no, actually, that interdependence creates its own forms of inequalities. And if you have a country that's a major manufacturer like Britain that's interdependent with a country that's really a producer of primary goods, there'll be groups in those countries who, yes, do rely on each other, but they will actually proliferate all sorts of other inequalities throughout society that will have political and social impacts and will potentially, if you elect a particular type of political party with a particular type of dispensation, we'll see that as a rivalry. We'll see that as a force. So it could be balance of payments, inequalities, whatever it is. Nesbitt says, you know, Adam Smith and so on don't resolve these issues, but they are issues that continue from the 19th century to 20th century and so on, and for that matter, the 21st century. So what I wanted to do is position Nauroji as someone who was kind of recognized this and was dealing with it in his own way. So almost seeing, you know, yes, India and Britain are part of the empire, but, you know, they borrow their own money on their own accounts. There is actually economic rivalry between, say, Lancashire cotton mill owners and Indian cotton mill owners, or Lancashire mill owners and Indian cotton growers, and they do come to disagreements about all sorts of things. Are Indians actually noticing this and saying, well, actually, look, we need to come up with a new way politically of approaching global capitalism that sort of smooths over these social cleavages in some ways, lest they lead to sort of, a collapse of the empire, or even kind of violence on the streets of India. We'll look at accepting that analogy things, but a lot of the violence between his community and the local Muslim community is actually caused by kind of commercial cleavages, not cleavages of religion and that kind of thing. So I would say those were probably the two major sort of influences as I was thinking about this from a political point of view. So why look at narrative again? And I've kind of touched on some of the reasons there. I always like this cartoon because I think it sort of sums up my attitude towards this. Is that what does it mean to create a politics between these two regions that isn't just the politics for India? I mean, what does a truly kind of Anglo-Indian radical liberal politics look like? And I think Nauroji was the only one really doing this in a meaningful kind of sense. So even his kind of co-liberals in India at the time are not especially interested in what goes on in Britain, particularly. So you might think about the Parsis like Feroz Shah Mehta, in Bombay, even people like Ramesh Chandra Dutt of Bengal, who's another great sort of theorist of the drain. He says that Britain is bleeding India, but he's exclusively interested in the kind of the level of rent extraction in Bengal, and he just wants the land revenue reduced. And if that's done, he's kind of happy with that as a reform. There's an interesting correspondence between him and Nauroji, where Nauroji says, look, this is small-minded. I'm not against what he wants to achieve for Bengali peasants, but the drain is a much bigger thing. It has much wider political implications than what you're implying. So I think this idea of kind of bestriding a kind of global political economy of empire and coming up with the universal politics of it from the global south rather than being a kind of Western theorist of it is the thing that he was kind of really contributing. And he gets labeled with this voice of India, the member for India thing when he's a member of the House of Commons. But there's interesting letters in his archives, again, when he writes to Herbert Gladstone, for instance, where he says, I know you guys call me this, but I see myself as a representative of Labour in Britain as much as the Indian peasant or, the ratepayer in Bombay or this kind of thing. So he's very actively seeing himself as a kind of global, radical politician, as much as a kind of exclusively Indian one in the way that he's portrayed in the literature. So what really allows him to do this? And I think one of the things I wanted to say about liberalism is that, clearly, I'm sort of with the literature that says that liberalism is one of the kind of foundations of British imperialism, right? It allows the colonization of places in South Asia because you hold up these set of sociological characteristics that people are supposed to meet. You encounter strangeness and then say, okay, well, how can we make you fit in sociological characteristics? So that's the sort of classical civilization approach. But I also want to say that's a kind of cultural sociological approach to liberalism and empire, kind of the imperialism of knowledge or the colonialism of knowledge, if you want. If we bring political economy back in a big way, and we understand the 19th and early 20th century as a period in which capital has gone global and the Indian thinkers realize it's gone global and are using this kind of globality as a way of then entering a debate about liberalism themselves, this does allow a potentially radical critique, so long as it's coming from a kind of South Asian or point of view of the global South. So other scholars like Andrew Sartori have sort of done this as well. I mean, he focuses on Bengal. He focuses on more of kind of grassroots response to this as well. It's Bengali planters who are engaging with kind of radical liberalism because they've recognized that the monopoly capitalist kind of, stealing their surplus profits and so on. But Nauroji does this from a slightly more, top-down point of view. So in a kind of classic history of political thought, he kind of recognizes that colonialism and monopoly capital have sort of become synonymous to a certain extent. So if the working classes in Britain are kind of trod underfoot by a type of monopoly capitalism, he's all right with capitalism in general, because bear in mind he's a business owner himself and so on. But there's been a kind of a negative externality of the way capitalism has played out. Whatever colonialism is just the extension of this kind of monopoly capitalism. So there ends up becoming a kind of Republican flavor to this liberal argument as well. He basically goes through the processes through which this happened and says, well, this is arbitrary. The problem with it is it's a form of arbitrary non-domination, and there's no form of redress within capitalism to get back to, you know, genuine entrepreneurs, genuine producers, and so on, who contract with each other on an equal basis. So yes, he's coming up with this critique from within liberalism, but it is a radical, in the sense that I think if someone was making these arguments today, I mean, it's almost sort of bordering on kind of Thomas Piketty attitude towards capitalism, right? It's not overthrow of the system, but it's an appreciation that monopoly, rent extraction, excess investment in kind of fixed goods rather than sort of productive enterprise and so on, is leading to increasing inequality in capitalism, and that is leading to all sorts of social and political sort of cleavages as well. And this is the thing that really sort of perturbs Gandhi. So I'll, that's Gandhi, Freudian slip. he's looking at a lot of what's going on in his own community as it's starting to frame, and eventually coming to a conclusion that this is more a result of monopoly capitalism working within his own community than any kind of social issue or kind of religious issue. So we'll touch on that in a second. But I thought, again, what was really interesting about this is that if we are going to, you know, make the claim that this is a kind of universal form of liberalism from the south to the north, then it comes from possibly India's smallest minority, right? So the Parsis, they're a minority that punch well above their weight, of course, you know, highly educated, highly socially mobile, very well represented in the early Indian National Congress and so on, a weight well beyond their actual demographic numbers. But nonetheless, it's fascinating that it's, you know, it's one of India's tiniest minorities that have this kind of global reach in terms of thought. At this particular time, and I thought that was interesting from the kind of universalizing aspect of this. So through this kind of recognition of monopoly, you can open up a liberal register for critiquing monopoly capitalism. But the interesting thing is that even the British critique, as we'll see, is very dependent on an Indian viewpoint, to the point that I don't think a British thinker would necessarily come to these conclusions at this particular time. So looking at Nauroji's life world, you know, what is the kind of Parsi world that he comes out of in Western India, Bombay, that allows him to make all of these sorts of arguments? So I think one of the most important ones is just the sense in which the Parsis are starting to have a kind of crisis of faith, almost, about their standing with the British, their standing in Western India. So one of the major things that the Parsis are throughout the 1830s and 40s are kind of the toast of the town. They're wildly commercially successful. They themselves are quite Anglophilic, but the British kind of recognise them almost as a model minority to some extent. So, you know, the sort of gentrification of the nuclear family, certain arguments from certain sects about how Zoroastrianism is a more rational faith than, say, Hinduism or Islam, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, needless to say, there are people who still do the old fire worship, like, oh, it's kind of city sort of thing, but they're certainly more with in with British circles than most of the other communities in Bombay at that time. The problem a lot of elites like Nauroji or educated Parsi elites like Nauroji start having is that the panchayat, which is a term I'm sure most of you are familiar with, but for those of you who don't know, kind of community courts, you know, they regulate community social mores, civil courts if you want, they deal with kind of, you know, marriage, inheritance, birth, death, all that kind of stuff. Starts to come under a lot of critique because the Parsi elites who sit on it, while they're presiding over cases of, you know, bigamy, inheritance, adultery, and all this kind of stuff, there's a series of scandals where they're seen to be involved in this themselves. So there's all sorts of allegations of nepotism. One of the key figures on the court is himself accused of bigotry and that kind of thing. So there's a reaction amongst sort of great good of Parsi society that, look, we want to retain our image as kind of vanguard community. But how can we possibly do so if you are the guy socially regulating us? Because clearly you're not up to the task. And so there is a kind of, you can see this in the Parsi press, a kind of discussion about what does a non-institutional social regulation look like, right? How do we get the Parsi community to regulate itself without having to constantly go back to these guys as being somehow the keepers of our collective conscience? And the original thing is social reform. So this is where Nauroji and his colleagues get involved in educating women, setting up more schools for young boys, getting more boys into the civil service, all this kind of stuff that's about really emphasizing individualism, rational choices in life, well within that kind of almost Christian missionary attitude about what sort of conduct people should be. So self-growth, to a certain extent, classically sort of liberal attitude towards these things. So I think that's one of the initial leaping points in his early 1920s, that's getting him to think about, okay, well, you know, how does empire socially regulate us? And is it, you know, necessarily doing the job that it's supposed to do? Not least because, of course, the British state is not wanting to get involved in it in a really, really big way. It's not really until the 1860s that they start to be a bit sensitive to things like divorce reform and so on within the community, because they're petitioned endlessly by Duke of Minority and his colleagues to do this. So there's this kind of sense of the imperial state talking a good talk in terms of liberalism, but actually doing not very much as far as they're concerned to bring it back. This, I think, is much more of a serious turning point. I think sort of communal riots that start to crop up in the 1850s and 70s. It's mostly between Parsis and the city's Muslim community. The initial one, if the official records are to be believed, is mostly between Parsis and the Qajar Muslim community on the one hand, but also sort of Shia groups during the Muharram festival and this kind of thing. I say to take the records with a pinch of salt, because a lot of it's the British trying to deflect blame for their own kind of incompetence, not being able to deal with these. So often the reason they want to kind of focus on the Qajars is because they say, oh, well, there was a new group of Qajar, you know, merchants who came over from Zanzibar or whatever. There are a new element in Bombay and they're causing trouble and so on. So it's a bit unclear sometimes about what the root causes are. But nonetheless, I mean, there is a series of these events which then sort of proliferate beyond Bombay as well, even into Gujarat and places, which really puts the Parsi community on the back foot, because previously they'd enjoyed quite good relations with, at least in Bombay, with their, you know, neighbours, whether they're Hindu, Jain, Muslim, or whatever. I guess the other thing in terms of, you know, in the context of the Parsi panchayat making itself look not particularly respectable, there's violence amongst Parsis or reprisals that some Parsis carry out against Muslim communities as well that are seen as, you know, kind of mobocracy and yobbish and so on, that really makes Nawaji and his kind of people of his social background think, oh, okay, this is not how we want our community to look. So again, he and the colleagues are thinking about, you know, what is the real cause of this. It can't just be religion, because we've been living side by side for such a long time, so that can't be it. And he starts to think along sort of the lines of, it's a failure of British policy, it's potentially a failure of kind of sort of political economy to a certain extent, because I think what he does realize, as some of the papers do at the time as well, is that a lot of the tensions that have been emerging between these communities are between traders. So particularly the opium trade with China became a bit of a cleavage point between Muslim elites and Parsi elites, as they were kind of fighting for control of that trade, and it sort of proliferated through the community. So in a slightly oblique way, but I think a quite revealing way, when he's interviewed about these riots later in 1893, he's interviewed because by that stage he's an MP, he says, oh, look, I know, his interviewer says, oh, this is about religious difference, and, you know, are Muslims inherently more violent, and so on and so forth. He says, oh, no, it's got nothing to do with that. There is a deeper cause. And he doesn't specifically say what that deeper cause is for India, but the rest of the article, very interesting, is about working class politics in Britain. So there seems to be this kind of understanding in his head that there is a political economy element to this. And in the early stages in the 50s when they're happening, he hasn't quite worked out what that is yet. But it's a very interesting pivot from that point to when he starts looking at political economy. So I think, you know, the initial chapters of the book, I was trying to make this link between these major events in Bombay and changes in his thinking. So this is the kind of thing he then moves away from. So he'd been seminal in kind of setting up these schools for female education. And I say moving away from, not in the sense that he's against female education afterwards, but he doesn't think it's the silver bullet for social regulation and socialization between different ethnic and religious groups that he used to think it was. And it's very interesting that, you know, it dominates his writing in the 50s and early 60s, and then just vanishes after political economy kind of comes into view. So I wanted to link these events to kind of be a major shift in his thinking. And as I suggested earlier, you know, it's really political economy that then allows it to have a more universal view of what these problems are. So this, I would say, in addition to kind of communal violence, is the other major pivot point. So interestingly, around about the same time, so initial communal violence in the 1850s, mid-1850s, by the early 1860s, not just his commercial fortunes, but the commercial fortunes of everyone he thought was a member of kind of, you know, a leading light of Parsi commerce is really, really undermined. And I mean, many sort of very wealthy class of families go bankrupt in the mid-1860s because of what's called the share mania. So this, just to give a very kind of brief gloss to it, was a massive increase in Parsi borrowing in Bombay to invest in the cotton industry, because the American Civil War meant that cotton from the American South was no longer traveling to Britain, and so cotton prices in India absolutely go through the roof. So a lot of these major Parsi families and merchants start to invest very, very heavily in completely speculative enterprises that don't have any kind of concrete, you know, basis behind them, just kind of sort of on the futures market, I guess we would call it today, you know, speculation in cotton commodity prices and that kind of thing. And then all the things that go along with that are sort of spurious economic enterprises. So people borrow massively because the cost of land is going up to just buy up land for the sake of buying up. Even buying up things like land reclamation from the sea. So, you know, something that's potentially has a real no concrete sort of goal in mind, and the land is never reclaimed, and, you know, they lose their money and all this kind of stuff. But what happens when the war comes to a close is, of course, cotton prices collapse in India. Cotton is being exported back from the United States again. The banks that have lent all these Parsis money then say, okay, we're calling it loans, and they have nothing really to pay back. So you get lots and lots of people, including Naroji, who declares bankruptcy. And this becomes a real sort of, you know, psychological kind of weight around the minds of Parsi prominent families, because they've gone through being almost unimpeachable economists in the 1840s and 50s, to now being a group that, you know, to a certain extent shows forms of irrationality that go with that sort of British idea of traditional commerce in South Asia and so on. Again, as a slight qualification to this, it's worth saying there's plenty of evidence in the official documents to show that the British government in Bombay warned white investors what was going on, and that they could see the way that the economic wind was blowing, and told them to dump their shares and all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, told Indian investors actually nothing. So, you know, it's all slightly weak system to say the least. But nonetheless, of course, the Parsis are really struggling with this sort of shift in their image. And you get this almost like we do or did here after 2008, this very stark contrast between, you know, Wall Street and a kind of real street, as we call it today, that finance is not being a legitimate form of kind of investment capitalism. And then what the Parsi press calls bona fide trade, whatever that might be. So this kind of intellectual impetus to kind of figure out what does that mean for us as a community, how are we going to get involved more in bona fide trade and less in this sort of speculative business borrowing and investing in the futures market. And you can see, you know, from these two quotations, this has a slightly larger relevance as well in terms of what we're talking about as far as social relations are concerned. So because the British government never really did much to create anything by way of a public sphere or civil society in Bombay, I mean, it's all the creation of the communities themselves who were investing in this kind of thing. So if it was a hospital or a school or some sort of, you know, intellectual social club, it was the wealthy members of the Muslim community, the wealthy members of the Hindu community, the wealthy Parsis in particular, who were subsidizing a lot of this stuff when the times were better in the economy. What happens after the share mania is, one, all that money is not quite as available as it used to be. So these institutions that you saw of as kind of cosmopolitan, where different ethnic and religious groups were mixing, getting along, even if it was in a kind of elite sphere, are starting to either disappear or fragment. And this idea that, okay, well, if there are people still contributing towards this, they're doing it in a much smaller way. And if they're doing it in a smaller way, it will be just for their own community. It won't be for this more kind of cosmopolitan world that we created in Bombay. So all of a sudden, this kind of lack of wealth, or this temporary lack of wealth, has raised all sorts of questions about, are we going to be able to continue to have a sort of you know, harmonious public sphere in Bombay like we did before? So you can see that the gaze is shifting to, how do you socialize people if you can't engage in lots and lots of charity works? If we can't engage in lots and lots of charity works, is that our fault? Or is it the fault of the British, who kind of read the capitalist system that doesn't actually work for us as a community? So that's where, you know, this kind of jumping off point for his critique of the political economy, as I suggest in this book. So how does he actually, you know, turn this into a theory, and what relevance does this really have for Britain as much as India? Well, the thing that really gets him out there in terms of looking at the social impact of this beyond his own community are these series of quite horrendous famines in India from the 1860s onwards, where there are millions and millions and millions of deaths. The British you know, either do a kind of Irish famine approach where they say, well, nothing could possibly interfere with the market, so, you know, this is just a kind of natural Malthusian outcome of what happens in an overpopulated country, or they do these work schemes that are, you know, on the verge of kind of labor camps where you can get sort of money to buy food if you're an Indian peasant that's, you know, his crop has failed, but you have to walk 20 miles to reach the thing in order to do a day's labor in order to get paid to buy the crop and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, if you're starving, walking 20 miles is pretty extreme as a policy measure. So what prompts him and his colleague Nehruji Furudunji to go out basically to Maharashtra and Gujarati countryside is to actually look at, you know, what the conditions of famine-stricken peasants are, and whether the British claims about them sort of being, you know, idlers and this kind of thing, and that's the reason they have to walk 20 miles to prove their kind of worth as genuine sort of people who are starving rather than being idlers. Whether that's true or whether the whole British revenue system is faulty from the very beginning, which not only leads to the famine in the first place, but it's also the thing that prevents these people having the resources they need when a famine hits in order to not buy food. So we're touching on kind of, you know, Amartya Sen-style social entitlement. You know, it's not the dearth of food that causes famine. It's market conditions and the fact that you've so exploited these people, they don't have the means to then buy food when the crop is not actually forthcoming. And as Chris Bailey sort of is the first person to really touch on this, you know, really advanced kind of statistical questionnaire methods. They go out there with a series of kind of 20, 30 questions to ask individual peasant families. Okay, well, you know, when the British collector comes, does he just ask for what you're actually supposed to owe? If you can't pay at that time, does he give you, you know, a month to pay, or does he use coercive methods, et cetera, et cetera? So, you know, are all the kind of official statistics, official claims about colonial political economy legitimate, or is there a form of kind of monopoly capitalism of the state, you know, extracting surplus from the peasantry going on here? Perhaps no surprise that he comes to the conclusion that that's exactly what's going on. So capitalism is not legitimate in South Asia. So you can see there's some of the questions he asks at the top. Does the assessment generally use surplus to cultivate rock fire after satisfying the demands of the government and paying the cost of charges for cultivation? So he's basically saying, do you have a surplus left to feed yourself, to send your kids to school, and so on? And the thinking, I think, there is to a certain extent, you have to think back to the charitable endeavours of his own community. You can only do that with surplus wealth, right? So there is a link being made between the very material conditions of kind of respectable political society, almost in this kind of Hannah Arendtian sort of way that, you know, you labour to create a political space. It's not something that just happens through goodwill or good policy, that it's a product of the material process itself. So, you know, trying to figure out, okay, well, if that's not happening, what are the causes of that? And how can we achieve that through kind of social reform, or political and economic reform in India? And he comes increasingly, the more he kind of looks at these ideas, to the conclusion, in a sort of Lockean, come Marxist way, that whatever wealth is in society, whatever we judge to be the accumulated wealth of the society, or accumulated wealth of a city for that matter, is primarily a product of that initial labor production, that is primarily a product of someone with natural capacities, but not necessarily the capital, mixing their labor with the land, and that is what creates the initial sort of capital. In which case, you not then have to make the argument that the laborer has a greater right to that share of capital than, say, the banker, who's not done anything really to acquire it in this particular logic. And that's the thing that really then allows him to extend this to the UK, because when he's in the UK throughout the 50s and 60s and 70s, he's then looking around at sort of, you know, British banking institutions and so on, after having examined the plight of the Indian cultivator, and saying, look, I mean, if capital is sort of stored up in banks, what rights does the bank have to store it? At the very least, it ought to be reinvesting that in the lives of the working classes in the case of Britain, because they're the ones who created that capital in the first place. So it's this kind of preoccupation with capitalistic mediation, financial institutions and other things like livery companies, which Britain has got all the time, which extract a sort of rent for just being members of them, are somehow illegitimate because they don't play a role in producing capital in the first place. And again, it's really fascinating because there's no evidence he actually read Locke, and no evidence that he'd really Marx at all, but he seems to have come to these conclusions by himself from these sorts of questionnaires and so on. The only evidence I could find that he read Locke was what he taught in Elphinstone College, but it wasn't his second treatise, which all that stuff is in. It was his other stuff about kind of morality and so on and so forth. So he's certainly not sort of, you know, borrowing this from the Western canon and developing it. Seems to be his own insights about what was going on in India during those times of crisis. Where this gets very kind of, I think, neatly and perhaps in some ways problematically linked to ideas of kind of social contract, you know, where do individuals use their production and consumption to form bonds with each other, is actually in prison statistics. So there's a kind of prison reform movement in India going on at the time, mostly headed by sort of, you know, middle class do-gooders, I suppose, like Mary Carpenter, who are there saying, look, we claim to be a great empire, but the prison conditions are awful. Shall we do something about that? Now, Roger actually kind of piggybacks on this, but then I guess squeezes a lot more information out of it in order to come up with his actual political theory, where he notices that a lot of prisons that basically are engaging in forced labor, they keep better statistics on what a capitalist economy should look like than what the official statistics of the colonial state are. So the colonial state statistics, certainly in Bombay, are village production or even production by religious group or caste. It's all very aggregated, it's all very ethnographic. And Naroji says, well, look, how the hell are you ever going to kind of understand the sorts of kind of economic relationships you need to make a kind of individualistic liberal society function when all you're constantly reproducing are these kind of, you know, ethnic categories or aggregated categories? What the prison statistics have are individualistic kind of information on, okay, prisoner X produced this number of kind of hemp sacks or whatever it might be, under these conditions, and he was this productive and so on. And Naroji really seems to take note of the fact that for whatever reason in the prison, caste and religion is not as much of a sort of socially defining category as sort of just individual relationships are. So he then uses that to kind of calculate, you know, the basic level of subsistence for an individual in India using prison statistics, and then calculates what surplus they would need if they're in the real world to form meaningful kind of, you know, cycles of production and consumption with their fellow human system or subject. So it's a very strange place to extract that data from. And he's certainly not unsympathetic to the fact that the conditions in these prisons are awful. I mean, he does get involved in writing letters and saying, you know, these things should be changed. But as a sort of data set, it's interesting that he's going to these sort of non-typical institutions to kind of extract this type of information and come to his own conclusions about it. So to get to Britain, I mean, what relevance does this then have for a particular British political economy? Like I said, with this Member for India thing, I mean, he writes to Herbert Gladstone saying, look, this is not a fair representation of who I actually am. And actually, indeed, if you look at a lot of his speeches in the House of Commons, there is much to do with kind of stairwell lighting and central things for which they are anything to do with India. And he clearly finds, you know, links in this type of labour theory of value, the necessity to get finance out of the land question and so on, with Irish nationalists, as you might imagine. And then they collectively are pushing for, you know, major kind of economic republican reform in this regard. You know, what sorts of institutions do you need to bring capitalism into check? And I think one of the really interesting things, again, that hasn't been touched upon because the housing navigated race thing is such an important part of the existing literature. He justifies his candidature to the working people of Central Finsbury on the grounds that he's seen their conditions in India, and he knows of their conditions in Ireland because he's been speaking to Michael Davitt and people like that, at a time when there was considerable xenophobia towards Irish migrants coming to that part of London, and this argument being that they're taking, you know, English jobs and so on. So he really leans into it. I mean, he doesn't kind of, you know, triangulate and say, well, this isn't going to play well. And I, you know, in that chapter of the book, argues that it's a major part of him getting elected. I mean, he gets elected by a very, very narrow margin, so much that he's called Dada by narrow majority, because it ended up being literally, you know, 3 to 5 votes once the recount was done. But nonetheless, he does get elected on the basis of these very, very radical arguments at a time when, you know, Gladstone was making similar points in the Newcastle programme, not quite as radical, but there was this sort of flavour of advanced liberalism. But you know, Naroji does lean into it in a big way. But it's only through that kind of you're in the same boat as Indians, therefore I'm an appropriate representative for you, that is the thing that actually gets him elected. And you can see, you know, when he starts posting these things in the local press in 1892, he says, you know, British Labour has enough claim to crop share everything is capital. So after all, capital is merely crystallized labor stored up and preserved. At the same time, he's giving talks at, you know, local sort of gentlemen's clubs and so on papers that say exactly the same thing about India. So he's clearly trying to make this link between his labor theory of value, the usurpation of wealth in foreign monopoly capitalism, and then a kind of at least an imperial politics or a global politics about how to get over that through various forms of kind of republican institutionalism. So what does that republicanism look like? I think it's worth saying that the things he suggests are tailored to the place. So what he suggests for India is not necessarily what he suggests for Britain. In India, so much of it is about control of the colonial state. So he, perhaps uncharacteristically for a liberal, I think, kind of takes the colonial state as a given. He accepts that it has overweening power. He accepts that it's authoritarian. He doesn't necessarily see an easy way to kind of roll that back. But he says if that's the case, if that's what it is, then it must be completely Indianized. Even if it's not democratic, even if it's not accountable, if it's Indianized, people will understand the problems of India better. And actually, he said the money that these people have, they might be, you know, gentrified middle class Indians, they might be laborers. But I can tell you as a gentrified middle class Indian that we're more inclined to then spend it on the things that go back to Indian labor, might be charity, might be civil society institutions, might be setting up a new factory, than the British civil servant who uses it to kind of abscond to Britain and kind of, you know, live the life of life or whatever. Say nothing of the kind of hugely generous pensions that the British civil servants was enjoying in India at the time. The same logic, I think, applies to his British suggestions, but of course this is now intended for a country that, you know, in 1867 has enfranchised some working men, is a parliamentary democracy, and so on and so forth. One of the things he really points out is that, you know, given the fact you've enfranchised some of the working class, the fact that you haven't achieved a greater level of kind of egalitarianism in this kind of capitalist process just goes to show that the system is still rigged. So he then comes up with these ideas to level the playing field a bit. As I mentioned, industrial courts is a really big one. So he basically wants to bring his statistical liberalism from India onto industrial courts. He says you can have labor represented on it in equal numbers, capital represented on it in equal numbers, but then you need a third party who had did what I did for the Indian peasantry during famines to say, okay, well, what do they actually get paid? Where is their money going when it's extracted? How much do they need to survive? How much surplus needs to be left for them to actually, you know, actively participate as citizens of British society to have a stable kind of political and social environment? And that is the way that you will kind of stop the various forms of social ills that are affecting Britain at that time. So, you know, there are not just xenophobia towards Irish people, but all sorts of kind of radical working class politics that's sometimes municipally contained, but is getting quite sort of tense in places like Birmingham at the time, and certainly London, which he knows quite well. And there are other parts of the world which the engagement is not as sustained, but he clearly takes an interest in. So he extends some correspondence to Joseph Booth, who is a Scottish missionary working in Africa, who again thinks the British Empire is exploiting Africans, and that's part of the process of kind of rusticating Africans. But then exchanges letters about what they might do in Zambezi industrial mission to kind of improve African access to the surplus of capitalist production. And very, very interestingly, I mean, you know, Booth is the kind of person that says you want to get the right type of English elites there to kind of manage this better. People like him, essentially, who are critical of capitalist structures, critical of how the official mind works, and so on. Booth doesn't do this, but Narrowdy writes to him saying, no, what's Africans? Like, what you want, Africa, who might be educated, and so on. But nonetheless, they are the people who will properly understand how you repatriate as well. So to speak. So again, it's not just an Indian thing, it's not even just a British thing, there is a real kind of global vision to this. And there are a couple of figures who actually adopt his ideas very, very seriously, partly through correspondence, partly through intermediaries. So he has a number of friends in the United States within kind of, let's say, kind of radical wing of the Democratic Party, who are in touch with people like William Jennings Bryan, who was a major kind of Democratic populist in the 1890s, famous for the Cross of Gold speech, which was about bringing the United States back exclusively onto the silver standard, because those, in his logic anyway, those are the, well, the silver standard had been the basis on which agricultural borrowing in debt had been agreed. So when America had shifted to a gold standard, the initial kind of agreement became sort of void to a certain extent. And he presented this very much as a kind of extraction of wealth from American agriculturalists by, you know, industrial and commercial interests in New York and Washington and so on. And actually, very interestingly, uses Narrowji's writings in his own kind of speeches and so on, particularly with regards to the sort of annexation of the Philippines by the Americans. So he says, you know, again, using Narrowji's linking of British politics and Indian colonialism to link American populist politics and the Philippines, it says, look, if you let mainstream American kind of views of capitalism run rampant in the Philippines, what will happen to the Philippines is what the British have done to it. And he's there's plenty of evidence and correspondence that shows that, you know, Narrowji was the book he was authoring at that stage, the kind of speeches he was reading. To at the very least back up his arguments, if not actually consciously influence them. I think perhaps much more strikingly, although again, there's only so much you can infer from the evidence, Marx and Marxism actually perhaps being influenced by these arguments about a kind of more universalist critique of capitalism, particularly from a liberal Republican point of view. Henry Mayer Heinemann, who is the sort of the social democratic figure in Britain at the time, highly radical, you know, or sometimes pilloried in the press for being kind of fifth columnist to some extent, has a very extensive correspondence with Narrowji. One Narrowji is not always terribly public about, because Heinemann is so often sort of persona non grata and is careful about, you know, how he's seen with those associations. Also, I think because Narrowji doesn't see himself as a socialist. So whereas Heinemann often advocates the nationalization of stuff, Narrowji says, no. I mean, I've been in India. I know what a national manhood looks like, right? That it doesn't work. So, you know, he's sort of treading a finer line. But Heinemann is communicating with Marx in 1881, and he says, specifically says, there's this guy Narrowji who you really ought to read. What we know from, you know, Capital and Communist Manifesto and so on, is Marx's views of kind of surplus extraction from the empire at best are underdeveloped. It might even be fair to say that he's not especially interested in it at all. So he has, you know, very sophisticated accounts of surplus extraction in the West, but empire is kind of an addendum. The letter between Heinemann and Marx is, I think, at the end of 1880, if I remember correctly. By February 1881, Marx has something published in Narodnik where this is totally shifted, and he talks about the bleeding from India and the drain of wealth and so on, and all of a sudden this framework has entered his imagination. So we can't definitively say that's where he got it from, but there does seem to be a kind of Narrowji influence in his thinking to some extent. And Heinemann continues this sort of you know, dispersing of Narrowji's ideas later on as well, sending stuff to Karl Kautsky, who was a major figure in Covington and so on. After Poverty and Un-British Rule is published in 1902. So there is this real sort of, you know, potentially global influence of a man who, you know, in the mid-19th century, there weren't many other Indians who, from this kind of theoretical point of view, had that level of global impact. To be honest, I suspect Gandhi is probably the next one, well, even that Freudian slip earlier on, is probably the one who has that kind of global impact. I think maybe you can make an argument for some of Vivekananda and so on, but that's a very different style of kind of global influence. Not less physical per se. So just to conclude very, very briefly, I mean, these are scattered down thoughts, but the way the book finishes, strangely enough, given the fact this is about liberalism, even if it's a radical liberalism, is to say the people who pick him up are not necessarily liberals. So the guy on the left there is Heinemann, and, you know, his is the very kind of Marxist socialist use of these ideas. But I think the key animating sort of thread through all of these is the kind of Republican approach to political economy, that there are forms of monopolistic capitalism that are forms of domination, arbitrary domination, that there are various ways to solve that don't necessarily involve the state. So for Heinemann, the state was probably the solution to this. But of course, you know, Marx envisions an ultimate withering away of the state. So if he did take these ideas on board, that probably wouldn't be the way he thought these problems could be solved. Gandhi's relationship to Narrowji is interesting. So, I mean, if you read Hind Swaraj, he defends him. Someone asks him a question and says, oh, would not the kind of, you know, founding fathers of Congress think you're a charlatan and so on and so forth? And he says, well, look, actually, I quite you know, agree with lots of the extraction of wealth stuff that Naraji came up with. He's the first one who alerted us to that, and so on and so forth. If you carry that a bit forward into sort of the letters Gandhi writes and so on that are about, say, the relationship between cities and villages, right? It's not a framework that I think Naraji would have expected this to be used in. But if you follow the logic through, what Gandhi's basically saying is that it's not necessarily that the British imperial structures are a form of capitalist domination. It's modern commercial society itself is a form of monopolistic arbitrary impingement on individual life in one way or another. The solution, as he sees it, is the Indian village. And actually, if you look at lots of the tropes he uses, they're very, very Narojian. So I find it interesting that he never, because it'd be very easy for him to say, look, Naraji was a great leader because he set up Congress and so on, and a patriot. But actually, let's just ditch the political economy stuff because it's not as useful as we think it is. But he never does that. He says, actually, you know, poverty is important. But my solution to it is different. But those categories of domination and so on still seem to run through his critique. And of course, Nehru, who has that again, the state is a big part of what he's doing, but that developmentalist attitude that's very much about capitalist structures impinging on the freedoms of Indians, so much so, not that they live in impoverished conditions on its own, but it impedes their political relationship. So you find again and again in Nehru's writings that, look, you can only have any form of democratic socialization if you get rid of poverty and all the ethnographic categories that he perhaps unjustifiably links to that. So fanaticism will go if you get rid of poverty. Brahmanism will go if you get rid of poverty. But you know, it's a silver bullet to these sorts of issues, which I don't necessarily agree with, but it seems to me that's at least partly an inheritance from how I present Naraji's argument, that this political economic critique is about forced socialization. It's about how groups in societies or individual systems of society relate to one another. And then the reason I picked that picture of Nehru is because the guy sat next to him is Minu Masani, who becomes a major figure in, as you can probably tell from the expression on his face, the Swatantra Party, which opposes Congress and Nehru in quite big ways because they're so state-driven or too state-driven in their aims. I think the conventional wisdom around that is it's a sort of libertarian right-wing economic party. From what I understand of Swatantra, it's not necessarily that straightforward. So one of the parties Minu Masani really likes is the Hungarian Cooperative Party in Hungary at the time, 50s, which was precisely that thing about smallholders keeping their profits, working together so that financial capitalism isn't necessarily mediating in a way that they're, you know, relating with each other. And there is a strain with him, a very clear cut strain, where he refers back to Naraji and says, something went wrong when we were thinking about sort of the relationship between commerce, exploitation, colonialism, neocolonialism, because Naraji understood that the state was not the solution to everything. Nehru forgot about that, or the Congress Party under Nehru forgot about that. So he sees himself as kind of redeeming the Congress in some senses. Not that the goals Nehru was fighting for are wrong, that he wants to see as kind of, you know, guess what we call neoliberal free for all. But that the state is definitely not the solution to this. And a lot of his critique of the Nehruvian state is in a very kind of Narojian, colonial, over bureaucratized, technocratic, the money, corruption, you know, the money's not getting back to where it needs to get to, sort of vein. So it's very interesting how Naraji's kind of legacy has been split between what are quite disparate political ideologies. But I think it's interesting through that splitting, it's the way the rest of the line in various ways, because that kind of secular liberalism has been banished to a certain extent. So I'll leave it there, but thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions.